You're listening to the Startup Growth Engine. This is a show for small business owners and startup execs looking to hear best practices around profitability, growth, managing a tight budget, developing a tax strategy, turning the corner with a startup, and more. Listen to hear honest conversations with startup experts who've been through it all with a success story to show for it. Let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you so much for joining another episode of the Startup Growth Engine. I am your hostess with the mostest, Maggie Crowley, and today I'm joined by Denny Sakis from Boston IVF, where he is the Chief Scientific Officer. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's a pleasure being here.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Denny. Where are you from?
So I was actually born in New Zealand, but I grew up in Australia. I did all my study in Australia. I did my PhD in Australia in actually reproductive biology at one of the sort of leading groups at the time. And then we had developed some technologies when I was doing my PhD in Australia, and we actually started adapting them in Europe. So I ended up traveling to Italy. I worked for a long time in Switzerland, lived in England for a while, and then In 2000, I came over to the US to Yale University for about 10 years. And since 2010, I've been in Boston at Boston IVF.
Wow. All right. You have certainly traveled around. Have you found your accent has changed at all? Or is it like 100%? It's Australian.
It's 100% Australian. So if I go back to Australia, it normally quickens a bit.
Yeah.
So even my children find it hard to understand me. But no, it hasn't changed. I think where you grow up, your accent sort of remains.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I have no accent because I grew up in Connecticut. And that has stayed the same.
Fair enough.
All right, little trivia for you, or a pop quiz rather.
Okay.
Who was the first IVF baby in the United States?
So the first IVF baby.
Oh, wait, in the world, not US.
Okay. The first one in the world was in 1978. It was in the UK, in England. And it was from two prominent scientists and a clinician, actually, Bob Edwards and Patrick Steptoe. So they had the first baby. I think the second one may have been in Australia, the group I used to be part of. And then in the early 80s, first IVF baby in the US was Elizabeth Carr.
Wow. And how many babies are born nowadays through IVF, at least in the US?
In the US, well, I think the worldwide number is 6 to 7 million now.
Wow.
It's a technology that affects a lot of families. So I think the current percent of babies. So I think in the US, 1 to 2% of all children are born out of IVF. There are countries that have obviously different coverage, so it's easier to access IVF. Think countries like Israel, maybe Denmark, where that percentage is in the 5 or 6% level. So it's a type of technology which affects a lot of families in the way they build their family and have children.
There's likely someone listening to this podcast that was born through IVF.
For sure.
Maybe more than one, hopefully.
Maybe more than one.
I don't know how many listeners we have right now, but.
Yeah. The numbers, it's an interesting, you know, if you think about it as a technology that has touched a lot of people, it's definitely a technology which touches a lot of families.
So you've been in this field since pretty much the beginning of it. What is that evolution of the advancement in technology and the ability to create so many lives been like? And that's a pretty broad question, but.
So I think one of the main things is that the first pregnancies were women that were infertile, obviously, but had like blocked fallopian tubes. So a very simple type of fertility or infertility. We've now progressed where many families, different sort of combinations of families can access IVF, which is fantastic. So it's moved from just infertility patients to a way of building families for many, many different patient populations. So one of the biggest areas is male infertility, for example. So in the early 90s, there was a technology that actually opened up IVF to men that had very, very, very low numbers of sperm, for example. So that male infertility is probably about 30% of couples that experience infertility. So that you can see how it's opened up access to infertility treatment for many, many different couples.
So are there ways in which you guys try to get in front of some of this? And do you guys also help in that moment when someone's trying to have a baby? But are there preventative measures and care that you guys offer?
I think all IVF groups are looking to improve the chances of patients having a successful treatment and going home with a baby. So I think a lot of our efforts are looking at different technologies, performing research, not just our group, but many groups, trying to improve the chances of patients to one, have access to IVF, to possibly simplify the process. It's a very stressful procedure, but most of all is to try to quicken and increase their chances of having a live birth.
That's excellent. That's awesome. I know every story I've ever heard from like friends who have gone through IVF, it's not something that they want to talk about because it's not a beautiful and pleasant experience. So how are you guys what are you guys doing to make that a better experience?
So you're exactly right. It's not a very nice experience for a lot of the couples. It's incredibly stressful. It's not just you come in to a visit once to a clinic. There's still a stigma of embarrassment, I think, for a lot of couples. And that even in a lot of countries, that stigma still exists. Even in the US, we see it. So one of the things we always try to look at is that try to make the process a little bit more amenable to couples. For example, a normal IVF cycle could take from visits to blood tests to treatment to finally getting embryos back and getting to pregnancy can take months. So some of the things that we look at is trying to minimize the visits even. COVID obviously brought a lot of bad things, but one of the things that it changed is the availability of doctors to do telehealth, for example. So I think that's probably going to stay a little bit with IVF. So patients not having to come into the clinic to do some of these visits, to be able to do it from the comfort of their own home, I think that's improved. We're looking at technologies and other people are looking at technologies to allow home testing. So maybe allowing the husband to do his sperm diagnosis from home, but also doing some of the multiple visits of blood tests and hormone analysis that patients will have to do. We can now have technologies that actually allow you to do that at home. So where you may have had 10 visits to the clinic, which are time consuming, you back and forward, you have to drive into the clinic, traffic.
Especially in Boston,
yeah.
I think we just got voted like number two for the most amount of traffic.
Yeah, and the type of drivers around Boston. So so if you can avoid that and maybe from 10 visits, you can take that down to maybe just the one or two where you actually, you know, collect the eggs, which is one of the processes, and then have the embryo put back. That's a huge benefit to the patients. And I think that will change the landscape of how patients perceive IVF also.
Yeah, that's nice, especially the like being able to do some aspects of it at home. Mm. I'm sure far more comfortable than doing it in an office. That's probably pretty sterile.
And less embarrassing, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So we'd love to learn a little bit more about Boston IVF in particular. When did you guys first start the business?
So Boston IVF has been going started off as a spin-off from one of the hospitals here, from three of the clinicians that worked in there. They actually set up a private clinic in the 80s. There was a stigma to privatizing IVF at that stage, so they were popular, let's say, because most of the IVF clinics in the US at that stage were all academic centers. It's obviously changed now. It's basically flipped the other way. So Boston IVF, from a small clinic in Boston, was set up quite a long time ago. It's now one of the largest clinics in the US in terms of treatment. Part of that is because Massachusetts had the foresight of actually allowing IVF to be covered, mandated by insurances. So the access to IVF in Massachusetts, at least, and several other states in the US, is actually quite accessible because insurance companies will cover it for a large percentage of the population. And in general, the number of cycles per capita in Massachusetts, for example, is two or three times more than states that don't have insurance. So that luckily allows Boston IVF to be one of the largest groups in the US.
Wow. And Denny, what's your favorite part about this line of work?
It's a very fast moving, and it's only, as I said, the first pregnancy was in 1978. So we've moved dramatically from there. You know, success rates have improved, the way we handle patients has improved. I think the acceptance of, you know, new research, new developments is quite high in the field. So one of my favorite parts is actually things that we are testing or doing in research have a fairly quick acceptability or turnover into clinical translation. So I enjoy it because the work we do in terms of research, it has a high chance of actually seeing it, you know, in a shorter landscape, a shorter lifetime, actually, to be adopted clinically and to help patients. So that's sort of one of the things I enjoy the most.
That's awesome work you guys are doing. What is the day like for Denny? I know you travel a lot. Do you also still get to spend a lot of time like in the lab? And
no, so we have quite a large embryology lab because we're such a big center. But I think when the embryologists see me come into the lab now, they shudder to think, what's he doing now? Mm-hmm. So it's been quite a while since I've actually done patient cases where I tend to go in if we're testing a new technology, or we've adopted a new technology, or we're developing a new technology. So if we're doing that, I will go in and do cases, but it's been quite a while. So and I actually miss that the most. So not being actually hands-on helping patients, but it is, we've got very well-trained embryologists that do that every day, and that's probably the better people to be doing it.
Your job is now to spread the word, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, and you know, that's another part of what we do is just trying to make the process more amenable to patients and obviously more successful. So when a patient comes in, they've got a much better chance and a quicker chance of actually achieving their aims.
So Denny, I know your main role, of course, is to, you know, make sure you guys are continuing to innovate and you're responsible for the scientific side. But how do you guys, from a financial perspective, make sure you can keep doing that and keep all this amazing work you guys are doing happening and flourishing?
So research and development, obviously, we're in the business of clinical care, but our group luckily understands the importance that, you know, having innovations and being thought leaders in terms of IVF, how important it is, even at a business level. So we are lucky that we have quite good support from our company to perform research and development, and part of that is, you know, we're lucky that we're able to keep that budget growing, but also have support from, you know, groups like yourselves, like Leighton, where we can actually claim those, you know, the work that we do. So it actually it helps us rekindle the research and development budget in terms of how we operate. So I think historically, you know, IVF was born out of research and development, and it luckily there's still an appetite there from IVF clinics around the world to keep that going and keep innovating the field.
And I'm sure it's nice that I think it helps to have, we have scientists on our staff, and of course you guys do. So it helps to really extract the most amount of R&D, and we don't overlook any of the great activities you guys are doing.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously, you know, research and development's easy to label. You know, we know what we do in terms of research and development, but there are a lot of things that we probably were overlooking in terms of what we call research and development. Having discussions with your scientists and your team, looking at protocol changes, for example, things that we thought were just run-of-the-mill that we were doing. But actually, when you look at it, there's a lot of actually R&D that goes into changing a protocol and bettering and improving the service we have in daily use. So there were items that probably we didn't realize that were under the banner of research and development, but there were things that we do, and I think IVF clinics do in general, that probably do come under that banner.
I agree. I think we've got a question from the audience, so please come on up.
Hi, everyone. My name is Allison Michelle. I'm a senior consultant here at Layton, and I'm super excited to have Danny here in the office with us. My question for him is, what inspired him to get his start in reproductive medicine?
So that's actually an interesting question. So growing up in Melbourne, I did my studies in science, and then I was working on stem cells during my sort of master's degree. And then in the news, there was actually a lot of talk about IVF, because at that stage, at that period, the Melbourne group was actually fighting, I don't know about fighting, but the English group for the actual first IVF pregnancy in the world. They'd actually achieved pregnancies, but sadly the patient that was pregnant lost it. And fortunately, Louise Brown was born in 1978 to the other group. But it was in the news at that time. And when I started my PhD, it was a topic that really fascinated not just me, but a lot of people at that time. So it was, I think, just out of general interest through media and that hearing about it and a fascination with, you know, you can do something that really will help patients in the future. So you could see it. For me, that was sort of even, I was doing basic research in what we call reproductive biology. I could see that quickly that would translate to caring for patients and improving patients' care.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Denny, for joining us. The work you're doing is awesome and inspiring. And we've really enjoyed chatting with you today.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. And thanks for your support for everything we do also.
Of course.
You've been listening to the Startup Growth Engine. Keep connected with us by subscribing to our show in your favorite podcast player. If you like what you've heard, please rate the show. That helps us to deliver business tips and best practices from startup experts. Thanks for listening. Until next time.